Hi, and welcome back to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Martin, and we're going to be talking about Tour de France stages 1, 2, and 3. We're recording this right before stage 4, so we won't get a chance to talk about that. And I'm sure everything will be different and everything we say is irrelevant, but that's the way it is. If you want to support the podcast, you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/btppod. And I'm also producing a daily newsletter, and you can sign up for that at beyondthepeloton.substack.com. There, the daily newsletter is the premium option, and then there is a free weekly newsletter that it tends to dive a little bit more in depth than the podcast, so I can kind of cover some things I maybe forget to say or just don't have time to say or don't have the visual ability to communicate via the podcast. So if you want to get a little bit more cycling analysis, sign up for that. So let's start off with, it's kind of an odd, if I was smart, I'd probably be waiting until tomorrow to do this, but there's just some stuff I want to talk about that I think we'll kind of forget about and move on after tomorrow, which is a summit finish, and we'll see some of the overall contenders separate from each other. So I think this is a good time to sit down and go over some stuff that we'll forget about and it will be irrelevant, but it is important to note as it will have an impact on future events. So stage one was insane. I'm sure if you're listening to this, you saw it, but there was all this rain in Nice, which hadn't had rain for like 3 months. And I think that allows like oil to build up on the road. So the roads were really slick. It was like littered with crashes early. The big notes here were Jumbo-Visma, the team of Primoz Roglic and Tom Dumoulin, stayed at the front and out of trouble, I thought, like very well. Ineos, I thought, looked a little shell-shocked and were drifting a little bit too far back too often. And I mean, Pavel Sivakov, who I hyped on this podcast for weeks, it crashed like three times and then lost. I think he lost like over 13 minutes. But it shouldn't be happening. If I think like back in the day, with like if Froome and Geraint Thomas were at the tour on the team, they would have been at the front. They would have had the team keeping them up there and out of trouble, and they wouldn't have been suffering these crashes. I think it was like a sign that things have changed on that team and they're not exactly what they used to be. Also, if Froome and Thomas were at the race and one of their key domestiques slash third leader crashed, you can bet they would have made the race stop. They definitely would have neutralized the race when that happened. But I thought it was telling that the peloton just kept cruising along as I think Andre Amador and Pavel Sivakov had bad crashes. So that's something to note. And there was also these theories in the peloton that the slick roads were caused by rain producing olive, like the olives were falling on the road and then getting squashed by cars, like thus producing olive oil, making the roads really slick. And that there was a truck in the publicity caravan for a soap company that was dispensing sample soap products, and it was like sudsing up the road, which I would be absolutely ridiculous if that was true. I tend to think that it was just oil built up from the summer and then it rains and it gets slick. That's more likely. So that stage was, I said in the betting preview, bet on youth. Let's go with youth. It's the tour of the new generation. And then the stage was won by Alexander Kristoff, 33 years old, who hasn't had like a sign of life for a year and a half. But he looked incredible. He looked good. He looks like, I don't want to make it weird, he looks jacked. The guy looks great. And he looks in really good shape. I wrote a piece on the Beyond the Peloton blog, I think like a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, that I think he's like really underrated because he looks so different. He just has like a different body than a lot of pro cyclists. So you don't look at him on the bike and think like, oh, that guy's going to be great. But if you look at his power numbers, I mean, there was like a Gent-Wevelgem, I think in 2018, where he averaged like 330 watts or normalized 330 watts for the whole race, which is absolutely ridiculous. And I think he gets overlooked just because of the way he looks on the bike. So that was fun to see him win and to see a 33-year-old guy showing the youngsters how it's done. And something to note on that stage, Mads Pedersen got second, who is the reigning world champion. So you'd think it would be obvious that he's very good. I never really thought of him as a sprinter, so I was really surprised to see that. I also didn't know how young he was. He's winning the youth classification, and I just didn't realize how young he was. Let's look up how old he is. Yeah, he's only 24 years old, so he's still developing as a rider, and he's world champion, and he's sprinting that well. So that's really interesting. Keep an eye on him to win a stage as we get into the race, and some of these stages get harder, and we see, you know, less fast sprinters winning and kind of the more strong sprinters winning. And there was a lot of controversy during this first stage. The cycling podcast, which they actually have rival podcast, but they have great info. They were reporting that you could kind of sense this going on. And I was watching a feed that Simon Gerrans was commentating on. He's like a really knowledgeable ex-rider. And he was getting suspicious as to why the rider stopped racing with like 60K to go and just started going easy. And then with like 20K to go, it's flat. The road wasn't that wet and they still weren't going hard. And he kind of snuffed out. And then what the cycling podcast reported later was there were backroom negotiations going on during the stage that the team directors were arguing with the race organizers to basically call the stage off. And the race organizers were saying, we can't call a stage off every time it rains. Like this, if we do this, this is a really bad precedent. Because why exactly are we neutralizing this and giving everyone who started the stage the same time because it's raining and the roads are slick? I mean, if you watch the race, the roads were crazy slick. Like you can understand the teams wanting this to be neutralized, but that you could see that getting stretched. I mean, what if they're in the mountain? They're going to be in the mountains this year and the race is happening later in the year. The weather is going to be worse. It's going to rain. You know, so are they going to neutralize those stages? It gets really tricky really fast. The organizers kind of lucked out because there was no breakaway away. So Tony Martin on Jumbo Visma made it like this big show of like putting his arms up and he's going to slow the peloton down. But I think that everyone slowed down because there's little incentive to keep pushing because you haven't crashed yet doesn't mean you're not going to crash on the next descent, thus hurting your own chances. So there's little incentive for each individual contender to push on. And you saw this happen where Astana said, "Hey, Tony, see you later. We're going to take off." And they were really pushing on the descent. And then their team leader, Miguel Angel Lopez, had a terrible crash because it was way too slick. Thus then neutralizing the stage. After that, no one tried to push on. And then, so they get down the descent, they're on the flats, they're approaching, you know, the sprint team should be ramping it up by this point, nothing's happening. And I assume at that point that the teams were still lobbying for the whole stage to be neutralized, that basically a stage winner will sprint for a stage winner, but no time will count so that everyone but 20 prospective stage winners would sit up at that point. That didn't happen. And then Benoit Cosefre, so I think that's how, I don't know, that maybe that's how you say his name. He from AG2R took off, and I kind of suspect that ASO called their team, was lobbying their team to make something happen, because as soon as he went, it puts everyone into a really tough position. They can't just sit up and let him go because then he's going to win the stage. You know, it kind of starts playing incentives off of each other, and the stage went back to normal after that. There was a crash after 3K to go, and there's a rule that on quote-unquote flat stages, if there's a crash with 3 kilometers or less, that you just get the time of the group you were in when it crashed. And Thibaut Pinot was caught up in that, so there, you know, it was important. You know, there were implications there. I think they extended the 3K rule out retroactively because it was not a quote-unquote flat stage. But there was some call, you know, there was some teams were saying that the crash, if they would have neutralized the stage, then this crash wouldn't have happened. But I tend to think that you don't really want to be neutralizing stages. Then it's like, what's the point of even being out there? And let's say they extend it to 10K. Well, that's just going to be a race to the 10K line. And then the crashes will happen then instead of 3K. So I don't think there's a ton they could have done. You know, it's like cycling is inherently dangerous. You're out there on open roads, it rains, and you might crash. So I don't know. I think they did the right thing by you don't want to get in the habit of neutralizing entire stages and just giving everyone the same time. That, especially on, you know, it's the first stage, but there was some tricky climbs and stuff happened. You know, there could have been, if that was a dry day, there could have been gaps and people could have lost time. So I think it's important to, you know, preserve the integrity of the race. Stage two. So Christoph wins that going into stage two, which was a mountain stage, which must be, I did some research. There was, in 1992, there was a hilly stage outside of San Sebastian in the Basque Country in Spain. It did not have the mountains that this stage had, though. And then in 1981, there was a mountain stage on stage three. 1977, there was a mountain stage on stage two, but that race had a prologue, so that was effectively the third stage, the third day of racing. That might have been the prologue in stage one on the same day, which is weird. They used to do these split days where they'd have two stages in one. And then the third time they raced was called stage two and on the second stage, and it was a mountain stage. Long story short, this doesn't happen very often. It's highly unprecedented. There was two big climbs before and then like two smaller climbs in Nice to finish the stage. The two big climbs there was like no significance at all. The peloton was like creeping up these things and the stage took forever. Like they finished, it must have been like 6:30 or 7 p.m. local time. So these riders are missing dinner. I mean, it kind of sounds funny, but I bet that must mess with their recovery and their body somewhat. And the second to last stage was, their climb was really, really fast. Jumbo Visma took control. They were hammering up this thing. And then the Kona Quickstep came to the front for Julian Alaphilippe, drilled it. Danny Martinez from EF, if you remember, he won the Dauphiné Libéré. And I got a little too excited after that, put a $5 bet on him to win the Tour de France. He crashes at the top of the climb. Has to chase back on. He actually caught back on, but this shows you the dangers of having split leadership. They could only bring one rider back for him, his EF team. So he had to work pretty hard to catch back on. And then right when he's catching back on, they're ramping back up for the last climb, and then he gets dropped. Final climb, which crested, this is like a finish of the Paris-Nice stage race. So it's a climb. It's not too hard. It's like something like 6K long at like 5.5-6%. Then it crests 9K from the climb and it descends into town. But it's a really tricky road. It's a small descent. In my opinion, a small group is just as fast, if not faster, than a peloton. So you can get you usually get these small groups that get away and stay away. Julian Alaphilippe knew this. I think everyone knew this. And the only thing that was the sleight of hand they used was he attacked pretty far out. Like it must have been, just off the top of my head, 5K from the top of the climb. So pretty early. Mark Hershey from Sunweb, who is just like a 23-year-old phenomenon. He's kind of unknown. He finished on the podium at Classica San Sebastian last year. But if you remember Remco Evenepoel, who is even younger, he's 20 or 21 or something like that, a solo to the win. And then like no one noticed Mark Hershey's podium, which is super impressive. And even then, the year before that, Mark Hershey won the U23 World Championships, but once again, overshadowed by Remco Evenepoel, who won junior championships, and then everyone in like pretty fantastic fashion. But Mark Hershey soloed to the U23 World Championship, but nobody paid attention to it. Long story short, this guy he's really good. Someone knew exactly what was going to happen. And he just jumped right after Alaphilippe went. No one else could go. I was kind of just on some Reddit boards and people were saying like, well, why did they just let him go? It's like, I don't think they let him go. Like if we looked at the climbing speeds on the climb before, it was really fast. I counted it as the 10th fastest ascent of all time. And some of those are standalone time trials where, I mean, you're going to go up way faster when like that's all you're doing all day versus like a 160 kilometer stage. So I would assume that they were about at terminal velocity and they were tired from the climb before. And then if you think about it, well, who could really follow him? I mean, Hershey was physically capable of doing it. Adam Yates jumped later so he could follow. You know, maybe Primoz Roglic, maybe Wout van Aert, maybe Egan Bernal. But those guys are all, you know, Jumbo and Ineos seem content to just kind of, you know, they actually played this pretty smart. They just like kept it at 20 seconds and then they closed it into the finish. So their GC riders didn't lose significant time. But then also they didn't have to put out like, I mean, these the three leaders must have been putting out massive, massive numbers. It just, that just takes a toll on your body. Yeah. And then like Valverde, maybe, I mean, he's not the same rider he used to be. I mean, 2 years ago, he could have gone with them and that's kind of it. I mean, Greg Van Avermaet was there, but he was probably just on his limit staying in that group. Alaphilippe goes, Hershey jumps after him. And then Adam Yates bridges up, who I think I was like I've been slandering maybe the last few weeks. I think I did advise people not to bet that no British rider would make it on the podium because like he could possibly get on the podium. He's in way better shape than I thought he was because he closed the gap so fast when Hershey bridges up. Hershey actually closed the gap quite easily, not easily, but smoothly to Alaphilippe. And I thought he looked like the stronger of the two riders. And then Yates just closed the gap like it was nothing. And that's something to keep an eye on. If he's in really good shape, he could be a contender for the overall. We'll get to that in a second. And it got really tricky because Jumbo was setting the pace on the front. Tom Dumoulin got his wheel chopped by Mikhail Kwiatkowski on Ineos. So then they're kind of stuck in a tough position where, well, do they get off the front? If the pace slows down too much, people can attack Primoz Roglic. But if they keep the pace too high, they're riding away from their own secondary leader, which isn't good at all. Tom was able to close the gap, which shows you that he's in pretty good shape. But I think it slowed it. It actually, looking back, it probably slowed it down just enough for those guys to stay away. Because they crest the climb. Yates actually sprinted Alaphilippe for, there was bonus seconds at the top of the climb. They're doing this thing where I think they call them like the bonification sprints, where there's, you can actually gain time just, it's like the second to last or last climbs of some of the days. And it really spices up the racing. Adam wins the sprint, gets the bonus seconds from Alaphilippe, and then they descend. It's a technical descent, really small roads. It really descends until like a K to go. So a small group like that can stay away. These guys know it. So it got a little bit difficult in the last like maybe 1.5K where it drags up a little bit. The peloton almost catches him. But the cliff notes here are Alaphilippe wins the sprint. He actually wasn't the fastest sprinter. Mark Hershey had a faster sprint than him. He just was way out of position when the sprint started. Adam Yates got roasted. Adam Yates knew he was going to get roasted. So then you ask yourself, well, why was Adam Yates there? Why would he invest that energy to bridge, to sprint at the top, and then knowing he's going to lose the entire time? It's kind of an interesting question. So, Adam could have gotten the yellow jersey I think he could have gotten the yellow jersey if he wins the bonification sprint, and then Alaphilippe gets beat by Hershey. So Hershey's first, Alaphilippe second, Yates is third. That would have tied Yates and Alaphilippe on time. And then I think what they do is they start counting back their stage, their places in each stage. And then whoever has the highest average stage placing is in the race lead. I think Yates might have been in yellow based on that. So that's a possible motivator for him to do that. But I mean, it's a lot of energy expend to just assume Alaphilippe is going to lose to Mark Hershey. He was saying that like he's not interested in GC at all. They're just here to win stages. He looks pretty strong. And, you know, the fact that he would be stealing those that time kind of makes me wonder if, you know, let's say like, you know, he doesn't know that the Peloton's going to close that gap. So he possibly gets away, gets some bonus seconds, and they win by like, or they stay away by like 20 seconds. And then he almost has a 30 second advantage on the rest of the GC guys. That's a pretty, that's like a nice advantage to start with. So I think that he's going for the GC. And if we look back to, if you remember 2016 Tour, which is the last time he raced really, really well at a Grand Tour, which, I mean, he's only 28 years old, but it's funny. You think the Yates twins, it feels like they've been around forever, but they were just so good, so young. In 2016, he loses, he gets fourth at the Tour de France. I think he loses to Chris Froome by like a little over 4 minutes. He lost, I think, like 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes in the two time trials in that Tour de France. And then he lost like 35 seconds on the final mountain stage, which kind of makes sense for a 24-year-old. You're just not quite as robust as the slightly older guys. So, you know, in most of the mountain stages, he was hanging in there. And if you remember, he had like sit last wheel. It always looked like he was about to get dropped. But then someone would get dropped and he'd just go around him. But he was, you know, so if he's in shape, he can be hard to drop in the mountains. And if he's stealing time in these like medium mountain stages, I think you have to consider him a real threat for the overall win. And the red herring here is the cycling media has like lost their collective minds or like lost their memories. And it's like, can Alaphilippe win the overall? Oh my God, he's back. But it's like, hey, we did this for 3 weeks last year. Like, what are you talking about? Like, we had this conversation every day last year because he held the jersey for 2.5 weeks and everyone was like, can he win? And it's like, well, no, he can't win because he can't climb in the high mountains. We got to the high mountains, he got dropped. They actually called off a significant portion of the climbing and he's, you know, still didn't win. He got fifth, which is good, but it just he didn't win. And that was about as good as it could get for him. And he was in great shape in 2019. He won the time trial from Geraint Thomas. He was absolutely flying. Even though, I mean, it sounds ridiculous. Even though he won the stage and he looked good, I think he won that on a little bit more of, it was more of like a finesse win with, he was using like a lot of race craft, just like good positioning. He didn't win it on pure power like he was winning stages last year. So I think that he's not in quite the same form as he was last year. And I don't think he'll hold the jersey as long as he did. And then assuming we get a 3 week race, there's just no chance he can win. It's so frustrating that we're just like back to the same conversation. I think people just like having the conversation. I can't quite figure it out. And there's a bit of like hive mind or like sheep mentality with cycling media. If someone says something, it's just like people pile on. But he's not going to win. It's super frustrating. We're just having this conversation again. He didn't win. That was the experiment happened and it failed. He can't win the Tour de France. All right, let's move on. But, you know, kind of the opportunity here is Adam Yates looks fantastic and he could win. I mean, he's likely not going to, but he has a chance at this point. And depending how he's climbing, you know, he could be really tough person to get rid of, especially if he's stealing time on these stages. So, you know, if you want to take that over to the betting markets, you could probably make some good money just, you know, strategically betting against the Alaphilippe mania at the moment. Two important things to note from that stage is, so Sergio Higuita, so Danny Martinez loses time on EF. So he was always a really flimsy GC contender in my mind. And this just like furthers that, like he was a little bit too far back cresting the Col d'Az, which was the second to last climb. You know, he got caught up in like a traffic island on some paint. That's just what happens if you don't know exactly what you're doing. So, you know, it was always a flimsy candidate for winning, but his teammate, Sergio Higuita, so I'm not a huge, you know, I don't think this guy's going to win the tour, but he is sprinting. So he's a good climber. He's like a small Colombian climber. He was in the top 20 in the sprint on stage one. And then he got second in the bunch sprint behind Greg Van Avermaet on stage two. So Greg Van Avermaet wins that bunch sprint, which shows that he's in great form if he's getting over those climbs. So keep an eye on him to like steal a stage here and there. But then Higuita, so he's sprinting really well, and he's a pretty good climber. So on these first week mountain, these summit finishes we have, so coming up tomorrow on stage four, and then that must be Thursday on stage six, I think he could be a contender to steal one of those stages and then potentially get into yellow. Let me check where he is in the overall, just so I'm not giving you bad info. Yeah, so 17 seconds back with Tadej Pogačar, then the rest of the GC contender. So I've just been really impressed with this sprinting. So I wonder if we're going to get to some of these. And these climbs are tough. They're like 7K long at like 6%. So you could like a really explosive climb is what these are going to be like. So someone with some pop like that could win and then, maybe get a little bit of a gap, like a 7-second gap and then a 10-second time bonus and they're in yellow. Adam Yates also, I would look for Adam Yates to maybe win one of those stages and then take the yellow jersey after that. Don't count on Alaphilippe to win the overall. And another note from stage two, Thibaut Pinot was, I thought I saw him struggling at the back. I'm not quite sure when Alaphilippe attacked. I couldn't quite confirm if that was him or not. But it would make sense considering his injuries from the crash on the first stage. It's just hard to recover from that. So let's watch for him in these next on Tuesday and Thursday. If he is struggling, we will find out on those stages. So today, we don't have to say much about today's stage. It was a real snoozer through some beautiful, beautiful parts of Provence. But it was like a class. It was kind of interesting because it was a tough course. I mean, it used to be in the Jean-Marie LeBlanc era from like 89 to 2005 when he was designing the tour routes. They were like snooze fests in the first week and a half, like flat as a pancake. And they would like freewheel along and then sprint at the end. Not the most dynamic racing, in my opinion. But it's kind of interesting to watch because this was a tough stage designed to test the riders. And then it's like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. It's like nature will find a way. Like the riders will find a way to make it easy. So even though it's tough, there was a lone French breakaway that's never going to make it. The peloton was really cruising, just like soft pedaling. Like if you're listening to this podcast, you might have been able to hang in there until the last like 30K. Because I assume that it really ramps up. Even on the easiest of easy days, it ramps up towards the finish and gets really, really hard. Then Caleb Ewan won the sprint. It was super impressive. I thought, I initially thought the stage would be too hard for him. But the way it was raced, those guys with the fastest legs are always going to win that. So, and he beat Sam Bennett. He looks significantly faster. He's actually struggled a little bit. So people were talking about him as like maybe a green jersey contender. He's just struggled too much in the difficult days to compete. He's just not there to sprint for the intermediate finishes. Sam Bennett's been a little bit stronger, and Caleb Ewan got dropped on the first day, lost a bunch of time, caught back on when they neutralized the stage, but then got like 19th in that bunch finish, which shows you just when the stages are a little hard, doesn't quite have it, but when they're easy, he's really, really good. And then Peter Sagan took the lead in the green jersey today. He doesn't look his old self to me. There's definitely a gear missing there. I think he hasn't quite been the same since he crashed at the 2008 Tour. If you remember, he was incredible in that race. He was actually climbing in the lead group on a really hard mountain stage, and then he crashed on the descent. And he's been struggling, in my opinion, since then. Not quite the same guy. It could be any number of reasons for that. It can just be hard. Sometimes you have a tough fall and it just, your body can't quite get back to where it was. You saw this with like really big cycling fans will remember like Roland Green was a Canadian mountain bike phenom. He crashed at the Tour of Georgia when he was racing road bikes. His tire got caught in a seam in the road and he was just never the same again. So, I mean, I love Sagan. Maybe he can come back. Maybe he can be good or be great. But even if he can't, he's still very good. Like he grabbed the green jersey today, looked great in the intermediate sprint, and he looks like he's going to hold on to that thing. These guys who are faster than him in the sprints, like Sam Bennett and Caleb Ewan, just don't have the consistency day in and day out to stay on top of all these intermediate points. And he was also in the breakaway on stage two. That's worth noting. But he got dropped. I mean, if he was at his best, he would have been there at the finish to contest that. Another note is Wout van Aert on the Jumbo Visma team has been nowhere, which is notable because I think, you know, he just has the, if we look back at like early August, he's just beating Alaphilippe in one day races. And like, he would still be beating him for these stage wins. He probably would have won stage one and two. And then he's just working for the team. It shows you how focused they are on overall victory. And it should be a testament to him, to his character. Not a lot of riders of that level would do that. So that's notable for A, just pointing out how strong his character is, and B, how focused that team is and the type of buy-in they have. It's really impressive. And then, so yeah, stage four finishes with a 7K long climb, 6.7% average. It's going to be, I think it's going to be pretty bananas. I bet my hunch is that it's a pretty easy stage up until then. I think they're going to, like, if you remember the early Froome years, it would be like, into first week, early second week, there would be a, like a pancake flat stage, and then they would hit a final climb, and Froome would, oh my God, crush people, like put like 3 minutes into people. And like Richie Porte, his teammate, would pull for him and then get like second, a minute and a half behind him, but still like a minute and a half up in front of the next person. It was, I think people forget how dominant he was in those days. And I think no one's going to put that amount of time into anybody tomorrow, but I think it's going to be similar where it's like super easy into this final climb. And it's going to be like a sprint finish to the bottom, and it's really going to blow up. Yeah. I have like a list here of like, it's like some people consider these riders to be quote unquote GC contenders. I do not, but they've lost time so far. So like Fabio Aru, I don't even think he considers himself a GC contender, but in all these lists, all these media lists, he always comes up as one. Mark Solera, Movistar, he got dropped on the final climb yesterday, which is notable because in 2018, he won Paris-Nice by getting away on that very climb. So that shows that he's not where he used to be. Danny Martinez, you know, his fitness might be there, but yeah, that crash just because he was slightly out of position. Warren Barguil, I don't know who said that he was a GC contender, but he's been like the hive mind has made him one, but he lost time. Ilnur Zakarin also got dropped. If you're getting dropped yesterday on stage two, like, you're not a GC contender. Like, if Greg Van Avermaet is there and you're not there, that should be a note to you that you're not where you need to be physically. We've had some, you know, maneuvering from, you know, like these quote unquote GC riders have lost time. They're not GC riders. So the real GC contenders like Primoz Roglic, Tom Dumoulin, Egan Bernal, even, you know, outside shot guys like Adam Yates, Tadej Pogacar, Sergio Higuita, Guillaume Martin, Esteban Chavez, Nairo Quintana. Nairo's actually, note that, Nairo's looked, I think, the better. He always loses time in the first couple days, and that's what kills him. He's always digging himself out from a hole. I wonder if the elimination of these traditional sprint stages has helped him. It's like less crosswinds, less, you know, power-based riding. I don't know. Just note that he's looked good. He's always at the front. He's always where he needs to be. He's not having the problems he normally has. So could be year of the Nairo. I've only said that eight times. I've only said that for the last 8 years. Velo News, I feel like their coverage over the weekend was like totally slanted pro Ineos and anti Jumbo Visma. They were saying, oh, Jumbo Visma's, their youthful exuberance is getting to them. They're spending way too much time on the front. They should learn something from Ineos and sit back. Ineos is the quote was the New England Patriots of pro cycling. Well, did Velo News watch the NFL season last year? Yeah, the New England Patriots were a shell of their former self and got beat in the first round of the playoffs, which is kind of feels like what's happening to Ineos here, where So their brain trust, like kind of the guy that would run their day-to-day, Nicolas Portal, he tragically died in the offseason. He was only like 40 years old, died of a heart attack. And it feels to me like they're missing him a lot. Like he really was Dave Brailsford is kind of the macro thinker, like the high level, you know, 30,000 feet altitude, runs the team from up there. Nico Portal, I think, was kind of their man manager. And it feels to me like they're really hurting without him. They've looked, and then so, yeah. Villeneuve was saying like, oh, they're sitting back. They're like playing possum. To me, they looked shell-shocked and lost and in good portions of stage one when those crashes were hitting them thick and fast. Like Bernal was even at the back. The peloton sometimes. You're like, what are you doing, man? You've got to stay at the front on a day like today. And then stage two, you know, they didn't do anything wrong. And Bernal's certainly looking okay. You know, he hasn't looked bad, but to me, and this is, yeah, none of this is an indictment on Egan Bernal. I think he could be in great shape and we could find that out tomorrow. But that team has not looked well organized, which makes sense. You lose the guy calling the shots and it might hurt you. So I just thought that was ridiculous from Villeneuve to be like, oh yeah, Jumbo has looked great, but let's find something negative. Let's find a way to say something negative about it. It's like, what are you talking about? When Sky and Ineos I guess they've never been dominant as a team as Ineos, but when they were Sky, they would control the race from day one until day 21. Like that was the model. They would just, you know, they would manhandle the race the whole way through. And that's what Armstrong's postal service teams do. Like, and then now they're switching their messaging and saying, well, that's actually bad. You should wait. It's like, no, you're not putting out that much more energy working on the front on a climb. And if you can control the pace, there's a physical advantage to that. Your team is controlling the pace. No one can attack because the pace is so high and you're at the front. There's also an emotional advantage where you are the ones controlling the race. And that, I think that allows you to go deeper and to push harder than just like someone dictating the pace to you. So I would give them like an A+. Like they've been fantastic. I think Dumoulin was maybe a little too far back and not paying attention when his wheel got chopped. That would be the only, if I was a teacher grading their first three stages, that would be my only negative remark. And they've looked fantastic. And I think it's super unfair to ding them for that. Ineos has struggled. I think they do not look their normal selves. And if Bernal is going to win this, he's going to kind of do it like he did last year. He's going to have to like stealthily use other teams. He didn't have Geraint Thomas was good, but that team was working for Geraint Thomas last year. It seemed like the support was behind him and they didn't have, I mean, outside of Dylan Van Baarle, they didn't have that many strong domestiques. So Bernal's, we know he's good enough to win without much team support. And if he's going to win, he's going to have to do that again because they're not where they used to be. And just trying to think of other notes. Oh, so we had a listener. You can email me at beyondthepelotonpod@gmail.com anytime, and I will answer your question. So, but we actually had a listener, Noah, email in with a question about Matthew Vanderpool, about the hypothetical green jersey threat. This isn't super pertinent to the tour, but I think it's kind of an interesting question for people who might not obsessively follow the happenings of Matthew Vanderpool. Noah said that, you know, he agreed with me that Sagan was pretty much a lock for the green jersey, but he was curious what Matthew Vanderpool's chances are of becoming a Sagan 2.0 in the coming years. He hasn't really moved in the stage races yet, but I see him as possibly the only man who could put Sagan in trouble. Where do you see Vanderpool finding success, if any, in Grand Tours in the coming years? It's a great question and something I do think about probably more than I should. We should just say up top, if Matthew Vanderpool was racing the Tour de France this year, he would probably win the green jersey. You know, we saw him get 10th at Giro di Lombardia, which doesn't even suit him. That's a climb heavy one day race. So, you know, the fact that he's that good at climbing, and you know, he hasn't had a great year this year. He's looked off, but if he could even be a shadow of his 2019 self, he could probably win the green jersey. It gets complicated because, so he wasn't invited to this year's Tour de France. His team, his Alpecin Phoenix team, just straight up didn't get an invite. So as long as he's on these rinky-dink teams, it's going to be hard for him to get invited. The reason he is on these small teams is it allows him to kind of choose his own destiny. He races mountain bike full-time. I think his dream is to win a mountain bike Olympic gold medal. So his plan originally was to race mountain bikes until Tokyo, in Tokyo Olympics, so August of 2020, and then go to the road. Now he's said that he wants to race mountain bikes through 2024. So, you know, if he continues to be on these small teams and is racing mountain bike professionally, he might not get to a Tour de France for years. So that would complicate his ability to win a green jersey if he can't make the race. I tend to think, I don't know if that quote is, it's maybe not fabricated. I don't think he was like maybe didn't really know what he was talking about or maybe got taken out of context, but I bet he's at the Tour sooner rather than later. It just seems it's such a big event for cycling and like the sport really revolves around it. He's got to get there at some point. It's a little ridiculous. He isn't. And if you want to be, you know, Tom Boonen got to a point where he was so popular and so accomplished that he just stopped showing up to the Tour. He had like a couple cocaine positive tests for cocaine, and the Tour said, oh, we can't have someone who does drugs like that at our race. And they barred him. And then I think it was overturned in courts, but he essentially said, well, I'm just never going to go back because it's a big pain in the butt and I'd rather at the beach in July. And Tom Boonen was so good and so accomplished and so popular, he could get away with that. I don't know if anyone else could do that. I mean, even Mario Cipollini would race the first week and then drop out to go to the beach when the race hit the mountains. And, you know, he was a huge star, but I mean, he knew he had to be at the first week of the Tour. So Vanderpool's got to show up eventually. And I think as soon as he does, he's going to be winning. He's going to be competing for green jerseys because I think the only one that can challenge him and potentially could beat him is Wout Van Aert. If Wout is never not working for the overall contenders, he could very easily. I think he would win the green jersey if he was putting his whole heart into it this year. But he is doing other things and we commend him for that. But I hope that answers your question, Noah. And Noah actually I responded to my, he's a comment on my daily newsletter today about tomorrow. He has a prediction that Sepp Kuss is going to be in a breakaway of non-GC favorites and he lost some time. There's a little bit of confusion. I thought he got off his bike to push Tom Dumoulin on stage two after he crashed. I've heard that was Wout Van Aert. But whatever happened, they both, Sepp Kuss and Wout Van Aert, both finished like 2 minutes down. Sepp Kuss is like a potential outside GC contender, so it's devastating. I have a lot of financial interest in this. So it's devastating to me that he lost that time. But that shows you that he's, you know, there's no chicanery there. He's really focused on helping these guys win the overall. So he seems fully committed to the team cause. If your team's coming to the Tour to win and you're super focused, it's unlikely you would be sending riders up into a breakaway just merely to win a stage. The only time you do it, you could kind of, Ineos and Sky, it's like the blueprint for this is in what they've done the past few years. They rarely, rarely put riders in the breakaway. They just keep everyone with the GC content with their team leader, and that's all they focus on. They do not care about getting riders up the road. Kind of the twist to that is, Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas have been their leaders most of these years, and they're great time trialists. So they don't have to take time back in mountain stages. They just have to defend their lead. You know, if they drop other GC contenders, that's great. It's all gravy. You would really only put riders into the break if you were a team trying to win the GC, but to have springboards up the road. So like Nairo Quintana is famous for this at Movistar. When Movistar was clicking before they all melted down into like a puddle of hate, they would send domestics up the road early, and then Nairo would attack, and then he has almost like aid stations up the road. So they can sit up, wait for him, boom, he's got a teammate up the road, drops that guy, jumps the next guy. So I don't see, it's possible. I mean, kind of an interesting thought of if there's a break, especially if there's like a outside GC person in it. You know, Kuss could be someone good. You send him up and he kind of keep, like, if Warren Barguil goes and you're worried about Warren Barguil getting oodles of time, you could send Kuss up there to just kind of keep an eye on him. And if stuff really goes sideways and that break finishes 10 minutes ahead, your hedge is Sepp Kuss. So you're not just, like, you know, digging yourself out of a 10-minute hole. Sepp Kuss would be, like, tied on time with Warren Barguil. If, you know, wouldn't be ideal, but at least you have some representation. So I don't see it happening, but I mean, he does say in his comment, he thinks it's a 35% chance of it happening. It would be super fun. It would be really fun. I hope it does happen. I don't think it's going to. I think they're going to stick together. I mean, they seem so committed to just this, like, strict, regimented way of riding. I don't think they're going to mess about with the breakaway, but I could be wrong. I'm excited to see what happens tomorrow. I think it's going to be a really fun stage, and it's great for us viewers because it's on a weekday. It can be hard to watch with work, but you just have to turn it on. I think the stage finishes, like, it's supposed to finish at 5:30. Maybe they'll actually ride fast tomorrow. Finish at 5:30 local time. So, you know, I think that's around like 9:30 here mountain time. And then you kind of just need to, 7K climb. They're probably going to do that in like 30 minutes, 25 minutes. Just throw on the last 50 minutes, 40 minutes. You're not going to miss a thing. And you're going to get to see some fun racing. I think Sergio Higuita is going to win the stage. I think Adam Yates is going to take the yellow jersey. You know, this is kind of a crazy prediction to make in the midst of this Alaphilippe hype, but I think that he is going to lose the jersey tomorrow. I don't think he does quite the form that he had last year. And I think Adam Yates is going to take yellow. And then our big GC contenders, I bet, finish at the same time. So, like, Dumoulin, Roglic, Bernal, I don't think there's going to be any time in between them. So I hope that... Sorry, this is a marathon episode for us. Also, one final note. So Alaphilippe raced, apparently he's racing on clinchers, which is insane. I mean, if you don't know, there's a little in the weeds, but there's like a pros race on these things called tubular wheels. And it's not like anything you would have encountered in your times as like a recreational cyclist, you know, where you have like inner tubes and then you put a tire on over that. It's all one unit and you glue it onto the rim. Obviously, that's a big pain in the butt. And why would you ever do that? But, you know, they have pro mechanics. It's a much better, I think it's a better system. They ride better. If you get a flat, the tire stays on the wheel since it's glued on. So it's safer. It's fast. They're faster on descents. You can go through corners better. Apparently Specialized, his sponsor, they have these new cotton clinchers that they say are faster in a straight line. They've been using them in time trials, but now they're using them. It's kind of crazy in road stages. It's just like, why would you ever do that if you had tubulars available? They're probably being forced to by Specialized. But the reason I bring this up is if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I'll get carbon clinchers because that's what Quickstep's using. Remember, they're on disc brakes. It's the only way this works. If you're using carbon clinchers with rim brakes, you will melt, you will delaminate or like melt your rim eventually. If you're coming down like mountain passes and like a, you know, on a daily schedule like they are. So just keep that in mind. I've personally delaminated two carbon rims fairly recently, and it can be unsafe because they'll blow up on you. James Wong from Cycling Tips has written like extensively on the subject and very well. If you're considering getting carbon clinchers to fit in with the Instagram crowd, I would look those up. Just keep that in mind when you're reading these stories about carbon clinchers that they really only work on disc brake bikes. And if you're a pro listening to this, stick to your tubulars. Don't be crazy. Just ride tubulars and make someone else glue them. That's like the smart thing to do. All right. Well, thank you for listening this week. And we'll see how it's going to be a couple good stages. I think Tuesday and Thursday are going to be really fun. We'll probably do like a Friday episode for the weekend. And then we'll have a couple more significant stages. And I'll check back in after that. Thanks for listening and have a great week.